Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Prudence L. Carter. Carter is an associate professor of education and sociology at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. She is also co-director of the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy in Education. She is the author of two well-received books about education, Keeping It Real, School Success Beyond Black and White, Transgressing Boundaries, and her most recent, and the one we'll be discussing today, is called Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. It was published by Oxford University Press. I'm speaking to Prudence Carter by phone from her office in Northern California. Prudence Carter, thank you so much for joining us. Now, before we talk about your book, Stubborn Roots, can you tell us a little bit about your early educational experiences as an African-American growing up in the South?
Yes, well, I was raised in a small town in the Mississippi Delta, and I, for the most part, let me just say I'm the product of school teachers, both of whom were raised under Jim Crow schooling, and they also attended the black land-grant institutions for college in the state of Mississippi. And I attended an elementary school, junior high school in the Mississippi Delta, and then high school in the capital of Mississippi in Jackson. And my schools, for the most part, were de facto segregated. They were about 98% African-American, but mixed socioeconomically.
And what was your experience? Was it during the time of civil rights?
Well, I grew up in the 1970s and 80s, so not quite the 60s, but I grew up during a time where white flight was occurring. In fact, I grew up in a kind of solidly middle-class family because I was from a family of school teachers, educators. And my parents now live in the same neighborhood where I was raised when I was in high school. It was at one time a mostly white neighborhood, but as black middle-class families began to move into it, those families moved out.
Mm.
And it's a neighborhood of teachers and doctors and lawyers, and even a federal judge lives across the street. But those families moved out, and it was a peculiar experience. I mean, so I grew up where there was a community and a culture of mobility, high expectations for us all. I didn't really, at the time of growing up as a kid, understand what segregation meant. It just felt so normal because that's what I lived. I didn't go to school with white children, but I had white teachers, and I had white teachers who had high expectations of me. And in fact, it was my white teachers, some of them, who, in conjunction with my African-American teachers, who put me on the path that placed me where I am today. So I did think that there was a really high expectation culture for us, of many of us, you know, it was just a parallel kind of black world. It was, as what Andrew Hacker calls, separate nations, separate communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Stubborn Roots, you did extensive on-site studies and observations and evaluations of eight schools. Four were in the U.S., four were in South Africa. Tell us what prompted you to focus on these two particular countries?
So my fields of expertise are in the sociology of education, but also in the sociology of racial and ethnic relations. And I visited South Africa for the first time in 2001 when I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan. And I remember being on a visit with some colleagues at a school, and this was not long after the country had become a democracy and apartheid had been toppled.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a mixed-race group of students, and I talked to an African boy, and I asked him, I said, Sipo, what was it like for you? What is it like for you daily to move from the township to come to this school, which was formerly all white and was now desegregating? And he said something to me that I had heard repeatedly in the American context. And he says, you know, we're grappling with how we're viewed in our communities. The kids back in the townships think we're acting white because we only speak English when we go home. And when we're here, you know, we struggle with some of the kinds of tensions that we have with our teachers. And in fact, I observe some of those things. And so I was very curious about what it was going to be like for South African schools, which were desegregating in a relatively more kind of advanced or progressive period in world history in the 1990s, how, and also being a black majority country, how the processes of desegregation were going to be the same or different than they were in the United States. And so I designed this study in four cities, where half the schools were mixed race, diverse, or what one could call desegregated schools, and the other half were majority minority schools. But let me say that all the schools were relatively high performing for their local context.
Mm-hmm. And you did this right around the time 2004 was a defining moment in both the U.S. and in South Africa. It was 10 years since apartheid had been toppled, and 50-year anniversary of the Brown decision, which
exactly.
Desegregated U.S. schools. So this was an incredible moment for you to be even looking at this.
Yes, when I went back, and there were a number of colloquia and panels and discussions around between the two countries, and it's not uncommon to think about comparing the U.S. and South Africa because of their histories.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing, understanding that both countries, also their economic foundations, were quite established based on the subordinate nation of indigenous groups importing slaves. So, when economists and political scientists and sociologists think about the globe and think about what's universal and what's unique to a particular country, we do tend to compare South Africa and the United States when it comes to thinking about racial formations in our society.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me, especially when you read the book. There are so many comparisons. Now you observed that in all of these diverse high schools in both the U.S. and South Africa, even though they were supposed to be desegregated, you were often likely to find some evidence of racial and ethnic separation, almost by choice. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It's something that kids seem to think, and I think many of us seem to think, that's just normative. It's normal because we live segregated lives. It's not that anyone wants to be malevolent or malintentioned or evil about the other. It's just that we tend to hang with those whom we know, and those whom we know are those with whom we live and with whom we go to church or mosque or synagogue or participate in social activities or who are our parents' friends. And so, it seemed to be very natural for the kids in these schools, when I would walk into the cafeteria, to see them segregated by race and ethnicity, which in the United States particularly is highly correlated with socioeconomic status as well. And I would ask them what that was, and they would use interest as the proxy. Well, you hang out with those people you're comfortable with and you share interests with, and everybody has their cliques. But I was wondering why the cliques didn't look diverse. And that's what I would keep asking. Well, I can understand that we all want to kind of, we divide ourselves based on interests, but why are our interests also racialized or classed, for that matter?
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, the same thing was happening. And this is where the historical roots are, where we would find on the plaza during break time, the African and the colored and the Indian and white kids would break down, and they'd also break down by gender, too. And they would say the same thing. Well, the white boys play rugby, and the black boys play soccer, and the colored girls play netball. And so we find that also, if you think about historically who plays sports, who has access to resources to do things, that can be racialized. And then that actually affects what happens in our intimate day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm. What did you find in regard to the educators in regard to this? Because this seems to be kind of an impediment in really desegregating and really trying to integrate, which is another path.
Thank you for raising that. I do make a distinction between integration and desegregation, and many scholars before me have done that. I mean, desegregation is what we've really practiced here, and is what I also saw in South Africa, is when you place kids in the same room in the same schools together, and then you want them to all get along. But integration is something deeper.
Absolutely.
Something harder to practice. It's about changing the environment, changing implicit codes and policies. It's about making sure that you're vigilant so that you don't have these unequal patterns that are groupings by race and class and ethnicity and gender. It's about making sure that the educational experiences within the school are representative of your entire whole. And that's a lot. That's different. In these schools, we found in the research that you could have segregation within so-called integrated, but in this case I'll say desegregated schools. And that was because we have mechanisms in place in the U.S. that can facilitate, like tracking was a big one. A number of scholars have done some work on this. I'm particularly thinking of my colleague Carolyn Tyson at North Carolina. And she argues that this has interrupted integration in American educational policy, the way we track, because ability grouping is so highly correlated with race, ethnicity, and class right now. And so in some of the most resource-rich schools were African-American and Latino kids had been bused for 40 years so that they could get access to, quote, unquote, equal opportunity, those kids were not having the same experiences as their more affluent white and Asian counterparts. They weren't in the upper echelon courses. And interestingly enough, there were other avenues in which they weren't really availing of the resources in extracurricular activities where kids would be traveling internationally as a part of the orchestra or Model UN or the chorus. And because kids themselves tend to racialize some of these activities, if they thought the orchestra was for the white kids, then they missed an opportunity to travel somewhere. And so these are the kind of mechanisms that actually impeded the ability of these kids to become more culturally flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a concept that I really focus on here in the book.
Yeah.
And it also concretized the social boundaries that can be existent within diverse schools.
So do you think when we started thinking about desegregation in the U.S. especially, that we forgot to think about cultural differences and how to bring all of that together?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments that I make in Stubborn Roots is that, you know, first of all, culture is harder to policy. Trying to force individuals to make choices is really hard because we live in a democracy where we want people to be able to make their own choices and have the freedom to do that. But the reality is a lot of what we do in our day-to-day lives, we're socialized based on the systems in which we've grown up and steeped. And that even includes the things we enjoy to do, the things that we select or choose to do academically. And yes, so I found that within these schools that the kids themselves were making choices that were reinforcing segregation, but the educators themselves were not vigilant about the extent to which they thought they were creating equal opportunity, but they were actually themselves encouraging the kids to make those choices, or they weren't discouraging them, rather,
mm-hmm.
Not to make those choices so that everyone could have a fuller and richer opportunity. And so it became very, very apparent to me when I contrasted the majority-minority schools that were well-performing how radically different their experiences were from their counterparts who were in the majority-white affluent schools. The kids in those schools, the majority-minority schools, were members of Model UN. They were members of the band and the orchestra and chorus. They were in the AP, IB, and honors courses. And part of that is because in those schools, the representation of smartness, of intelligence, of up-and-coming was much broader. It was more representative of the entire school population compared to the more affluent white schools.
And do you think that was because the window of opportunity had sort of opened up and given people a broader perspective about culture?
Yes. So the cultural formations in those schools centered around, first of all, the schools fostered a culture of expectation for all of the kids that was representative of all the kids. What happened in the more affluent majority white schools is that it was almost becoming kind of everyday common sense that, well, and you know, it's the narrative, the achievement gap narrative. Well, we don't expect that these kids are going to do as well. They come from poor family backgrounds. They don't tend to do these things. And the educators don't push them to do those things or encourage them to do those things or figure out a way to facilitate the conversation so that we can say, how can we make our student government, for example, more representative of us all? What would it take for us to make sure that there are more of us in Model UN or in the orchestra? Or for that matter, for the things that we're seeing more traditionally black, like the step club, where there's a dance club. You know, how do we invite white youth and Asian youth into these things? Now, some of it is not to say that we want to annihilate those kinds of cultural practices that are more ethnically oriented, because I do think that there is space for that. I think the problem comes in is when activities become conducive to some kind of mobility, to some kind of resource that can facilitate a kid's like going to college or becoming a more civic participant or, you know, something, getting recognition, being a high achiever. And we do know that some of these things can really deeply engage kids so that they can do better in school. So it is important to talk about the way these formations are happening, how they become enculturated in schools. I think most of us think that equalizing opportunity is just about the hard material things, making sure you got enough money, enough great physical plant, high-quality teaching. They all matter. They absolutely matter. And I'm saying we have to pay attention to these kind of more intangible cultural mechanisms or processes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Prudence Carter. We're talking about her book, Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. Now, Prudence, I really thought it was kind of scary how you found that in both U.S. and South African desegregated schools. Many of the students didn't want to talk about the past. You know, it was like racial fatigue, harping on past discrimination. They didn't want to talk about that. To tell us about that.
Well, you know, I see that even sometimes among my graduate students at Stanford. I think we live in a society right now where there's just angst about talking about inequality, particularly when it pertains to race. I mean, at this point, what's most salient is we think that socioeconomic status is really what matters. Mm. And that's supplanting the racial analysis. Fundamentally, we know that there has been improvement for historically disadvantaged groups by race and ethnicity, socioeconomically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do we do about the poor? So I want to be clear that I'm not disavowing that. But at the same time, there are so many dominant, enduring, racialized patterns in our schools, in our society, in our economy, and there are intersections between what happens with class and race. And so, you know, in South Africa, they haven't been talking about it that long in terms of the curriculum, mm-hmm. and the kids were already tired of it. You know, I had a kid say to me explicitly, that was our parents and our grandparents' generation. That doesn't have anything to do with us. And I think part of that is because there is a lot of fear and threat around affirmative action processes. South Africa cannot ameliorate its historical condition of exclusion without opening up opportunity for its majority population, which are African people. And so they have implemented some affirmative action policies in the higher education, for example, to make sure that there are people who are black who are going to be getting college degrees. And they've done it understanding that there's been all this historic disadvantage in terms of resources. But that feels threatening to the white youth, of course, because for the first time they now have to compete with the majority of the population. And so there is some fatigue about this. I mean, I think part of this is it's too overwhelming. I don't want to have to deal with this. It's not fair. That's a very complicated term when you're thinking about years of exclusion for a majority of your people.
Absolutely.
And also thinking, well, now that we're in this is the first generation that's just come the full time through school, all of secondary school, where they weren't under apartheid. So they do think it's bygone.
Mm. You know, I witnessed that too when I was in Germany about 20 years ago. I remember some of the German youth didn't want to talk about the Holocaust because it was their grandparents and it had nothing to do with them. But we know the danger of trying to bury some of our past. The thing that also really kind of shocked me is how much you witnessed a lot of racism and stereotypes, especially in the desegregated schools in South Africa. You said that some of the white teachers there would tell you that black teachers are lazy, right to your face.
Oh, yes. That was a fascinating experience for me because as a sociologist, it also was representative of the fact that one's status can just be movable. It changes. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think in the South African context, as a researcher, I was given the privilege of just being perceived as an American, a raceless American. Mm. And Americans are sometimes attributed really high status. And so things were said to me not like I was a black person, or maybe they were. I can't tell. And they just didn't care. But yes, I mean, in South Africa, because that country's educational policy context is different, a lot of the inequality around race and culture manifested around specific stereotypes and cultural practices. And so the beliefs about Africans, about blacks, are still deeply ingrained, particularly in the generation who was born under apartheid and who lived and was socialized under that. And those are the educators. We're just coming into a generation of teachers who may have gone to school under the tail end, but for the most part were raised under democracy. But the teachers I encountered in 2004, 2008, as I was doing this, they're not retired yet. They're still relatively young. Many of those teachers do believe fundamentally that the other groups that are not white are intellectually inferior. So they believe that the black teachers are lazy, that they weren't as good. I mean, it is real that black teachers under apartheid were not trained as well. You know, that's real because their schools were just, I mean, the disproportionality in terms of resources, just the quality of what they had access to was fundamentally different and certainly not as good. But to say that black teachers, when I went into those schools, I wasn't witnessing lazy teachers. When I was into township schools, I was witnessing teachers who were trying to do the best they could with barely nothing.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I was going to say that in the U.S., those attitudes are still wandering around. They just don't say it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, they wouldn't say it to a black woman's face for sure, like they did in South Africa. That was shocking to me when you said that in your book.
It is the case of the apartheid ideology, the mentality, that it's about indoctrination. It's about being desocialized, deconditioned. And the black body, the black person, is just not an equal. So I certainly know that she had absolutely no problem saying that to me. But when I tried to make the comparison with how African Americans are talked about in the U.S., what was interesting sociologically is that she elevated our status compared to black Africans. And so I think African Americans are quite clever and smart. This is the principal of the school I think you're talking about. And, you know, look what you did during the civil rights era. Well, the same thing was happening during the resistance movement for South African blacks. So the parallels are enormous, but I think that we tend to treat those who are our subordinate groups in the society just bad.
Yeah.
We'll value someone else's other, but we won't value our own other.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson to have witnessed.
Yeah.
But to talk about the school cultures and how they often try to homogenize to fit, you know, majority mores and standards. You talked a lot about black girls' hairstyles and how, what a fight that was to let people be part of their own cultures.
Right. Two of the things in South Africa, as I mentioned, the cultural practices and taste were ways in which I saw blatant inequality. Well, hair has some really strong political meaning in our society.
Absolutely.
For some reason, particularly when it comes to black women's hair or black girls' hair. And when I first arrived in 2001, before I even began the study, the kids at this school, some black girls came up to me and they asked me if I would intervene and talk to the school governing body on their behalf because they couldn't wear their hair like mine. And I wear my hair is a short cornrow twist, as you can. And at that time, I was a professor at Harvard. And I went to the principal because I was curious about this. I was like, wow. And she basically told me they didn't see it as normal. It was nonconformist. It wasn't respectful. They can do that on the weekend. And there I was sitting there thinking, wow, here I am thinking I'm an accomplished person. And she just told me that the way I wear my hair is not normal. And so I went back years later when I started the research and I included the school in the process. And the same issue was salient. But then I was reading about it in the newspaper because there was a young white girl who had attended a very fancy private school who had gone on vacation with her parents and had gotten her hair braided, and she came to school that way, and the school sent her home. And then in one of my other schools in the sample, that school, too, had struggled with the issue. But over time, the principal realized that it was actually just fundamentally unfair, and they changed the policy. Whereas the first school, the initial school, absolutely refused to. And that's why I make the argument that the ideology of the educators matter a lot. When the educators are open to egalitarianism, you can see a lot of change in the school. If they're trying to maintain a certain kind of ideology about assimilation or acculturation and expectations, and that can happen not just with hair, but with language, you know, we have a particular ideology in this country about language. In South Africa, there are 11 national languages in that country, but their most affluent schools, their formal all-white schools, only teach two, and those are the languages of the dominant groups, English and Afrikaans.
Yeah.
What happened to the African languages? So these were other ways in which we saw inequality manifesting itself, even if at the policy level the discourse was about equality.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, what are your thoughts about the move toward school choice in this country, which often means, you know, charter schools and moving away from public schools?
Well, I actually think that there is enough room for multiple models of schooling in American society. We have a broad landscape. And so there is sufficient room for us to have some forms of choice. I am a product of public schools. I think they work when the resources and when we practice them well. I think the same issues, if we were to scale choice so that all of us were mandated to do choice, would follow us because we can't escape the sociological forces and just be in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
What I do know about school choice today, and this study wasn't about school choice, let me just say that, but the things that you're talking about, I've had people say, we don't care about that anymore. People are away from that. They're about choice. Well, choice is also, unfortunately, highly correlated with segregation right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is choice going to ultimately get us where we want to in terms of incorporating groups that have been historically underperforming and disadvantaged in the society? And I don't see how that's going to be any different than living in a segregated context. We will still have a status hierarchy in terms of education. Now, mind you, some of the choice programs, some of the schools that are under choice are doing well. others are not. The jury is still out on whether or not this is the best way to go as an educational reform practice. For me, the larger issue is not just about education in terms of performance, but how we use our social schools as institutions to help to strengthen and enrich a democracy.
Mm.
And so, and that's a larger project. And so Stubborn Roots, for me, the reason I think this issue is a failed historical moment. We've celebrated more than 50 years. We're going towards 60 years of Brown. And if we can fundamentally say in this society we don't care about integration anymore, then we're also saying that we don't care about having the strongest and richest democracy anymore, because it has implications for us as citizens, how we interact civically, how we allocate resources, all of those kinds of things. And I think that's the question I'm trying to take on also with this book. That's a big question. It's a complex question, but it really does have implications for how democratic we really are.
Yeah, I agree with you, absolutely. I know your interest in general is education. So can I ask you this? Has Obama's election changed anything on the educational landscape, especially in this country, that you've noticed?
I think the Obama administration has been trying to reinforce and in some ways reproduce the No Child Left Behind Act, which was an incarnation of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, implemented, mandated. I mean, mind you, we're at the stage with the Race to the Top policies where states are now getting waivers to be able to bag out. But I am worried in terms of broader implications. We're now getting into a place where the testing and accountability, I think we're backing ourselves into a corner. And I'm not sure that I would suggest that the Obama administration has taken the most progressive turn on education. It's actually not that far off from what the prior administration was doing, because we have a lot of angst right now in American society about how well we compare on tests to other kids around the world.
Yeah.
But we don't understand that how those countries that are doing well, their approach to education is different to ours, particularly some of the northern European countries like Finland that we compare ourselves to. They have a much more radical approach to equity in schooling and equality in schooling. They're not narrowing the conceptualization of achievement to a test score metric. They just happen to teach their kids really well, and then they do, you know, and they incorporate all their kids really well, and they train their teachers, and they respect their teachers, and their teachers are all unionized, and then they have this kind of healthy educational context that produces these kids who do pretty well. We don't quite have all those other contextual factors in place. So to get back to your question, I think the Obama administration is still very much committed to the kind of grading of teachers and students. And that grading of teachers and students is really fomenting the narrative of underperformance of historically disadvantaged groups, particularly kids who don't come from very, we know the family background determines parents' education, parent wealth, and stuff are strong determinants of how well kids perform on tests. When kids come from low-income homes where their parents may not have the educational backgrounds or even the time to really help or the time to invest in tutors and resources, those kids are not going to do as well on the test, and they're becoming demoralized because the dominant narrative is that they are not smart.
Prudence, we're almost out of time here. This has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Can you give some contact information or a place where people could buy your book?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Obviously, I would encourage people to contact their local bookstores because you can get it. There are online bookstores, and Oxford University Press has its own website on Oxford University Press. Just Stubborn Roots, Prudence Carter, put it in the search engine. It will come up. And to contact me, I'm easily available at Stanford University in the School of Education.
Great. Well, Prudence Carter, thank you so much. Again, the book is called Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. Prudence Carter, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.